We have gone through the description given by the Venerable Buddhaghosa about the development of fetus in its mother's womb. Now there is another statement made by another teacher who was later than the Venerable Buddhaghosa. The name of the book is Abhidhammata Vibhavini. So in that book, first week to fifth week are the same, but that book states that during the seventh week, eye sensitivity Dagat is produced, and 8th week ear, 9th week nose sensitivity, and 10th week tongue sensitivity is produced. So there are two statements here, but almost all teachers accept the statement by the Venerable Buddhaghosa and not of the Abhidhammata Vibhavini. And it is explained in this way. The Venerable Buddhaghosa was a celebrated commentator, and in one of his commentaries he wrote about this. So when he wrote, he used the word 77 nights. So at the 77 nights, the eye, Jagat, and others are produced. Now, our teachers, the eye, Jagat, and others are produced. Now, our teachers explained to us that the commentary which the second author, the commentary of the first author which the second author read must have a different reading. Instead of 77 nights, he must have 77 nights. So 77 nights means 49 nights or 7 weeks. So he wrote that it was during the seventh week that eye sensitivity was produced, and so on. So on the next page, I give you the text from Samyutta Nikaya, and then the explanation given by the commentary to Samyutta Nikaya. So that commentary was written by Venerable Buddhaghosa. So I read that. First there is Kalala. After Kalala there is Abuddha. After Abuddha it becomes Pesi. Pesi becomes Gana. After Gana, Pasakhas arise, and also head hair, body hair, and nails. So this is the words of the Buddha in one of the discourses in Samyutta Nikaya. Now the commentary explains as follows. Together with the first relinking consciousness, there are no names as Tissa or Pusa, but there is Kalala, which is as much as a drop of oil hanging on the tip of a single thread made of 3 hairs of a newborn kid's wool. So very delicate, very small hair. And the Kalala is as much as a drop of oil hanging on the tip of the single thread made of 3 hairs of a newborn kid's wool. With reference to that, it is said, like a drop of sesame oil or of unclouded cream of ghee, thus the counterpart appearance is Kalala said to have. After Kalala, there is Abuddha. After the lapse of a week from that stage of Kalala, it becomes Abuddha. It develops into what is called Abuddha, which has the appearance of water with which meat has been washed. The name Kalala at that time disappears. It is no longer called Kalala, but now it is called Abuddha. After Abuddha, it becomes Pesi. Also from that stage of Abuddha, after the lapse of a week, it becomes Pesi by name which resembles molten lead. The name Abuddha disappears. Pesi becomes Ghana. From the Pesi, after the lapse of a week, it becomes Ghana by name, a lump of flesh resembling an egg of a hen. The name Pesi disappears. After Ghana, Basakhas arise. During the fifth week, five swellings appear for two hands and two feet and the head. From here, skipping the sixth, seventh, and other weeks, and condensing the discourse, the Buddha said, Kesa, etc., to show the time of growth during the 42nd week. So Buddha skipped 6, 7 and other weeks, and then he jumped to 42nd week. And also head hair, body hair and nails. These appear during the 42nd week. That is the statement of the Venerable Buddha Gosa. In another commentary, it is said, to those born of mother's womb among the internal bases, only manayatana, mind base, and kayayatana, body base, arise at the moment of relinking. The rest four bases, chakhu, sota, ghana, and jiva bases, eye base, ear base, nose base, and tongue bases, at 77th night, in Pali, Satta Satati Ratimhi. So this is a commentary to Kathavatthu, which is one of the books of Abhidhamma. So our teachers explained that Satta Satati Ratimhi appeared to be Satta Satta Ratimhi, not Satta Satati. Sada, sada. Sada means seven, sada means seven. So seven, seven nights means seven nights multiplied by seven. So the Abhidhammata Vibhavani must have found that reading, and so he said during the seventh week the eye sensitivity is produced and so on. Now, at the moment of Patisandhi, what arises? Let's say human Patisandhi. Now, at the moment of conception, what arises is the group of three. Patisandhi, Chitta, that is one of the resultant types of consciousness, and then along with it, some Chetasikas, and then 30 Rupas. So according to teachings of Abhidhamma, life begins at the moment of Patisandhi. Not like people now say, only about 4 months is life said to be existent. So according to Abhidhamma, life begins with the moment of conception. So even though it may be a kalala or just a piece of matter, in that matter or in that group, there is the heart base, maybe very small heart base. So on that heart base, the consciousness depends. So since there is consciousness, there is heart base, and there is what is called life faculty, we understand that according to Abhidhamma, life begins as soon as a being takes conception in the mother's womb, and not 4 months later or some months later. Now the manual explains to us how the material properties arise and so on. So thus the continuity of material groups produced in four ways, namely karma born from the time of rebirth linking, consciousness born from the second moment of consciousness, temperature born from the time of the stage of presence, nutrition born from the time of the diffusion of nutritive essence, uninterruptedly flows on the sense sphere till the end of life, like the flame of a lamp or the stream of a river. Just like consciousness rising and disappearing, and the flow of consciousness goes on and on, the flow of material properties also flows on and on, like a flame of lamp or the stream of a river. So you look at a flame and you think it is the same flame, but actually at every moment the flame changes. The same with looking at a stream of the river. So you think that the water is the same, but actually at every moment and there is new water. So in the same way, although we think that the material properties last, actually they don't. They just arise and they disappear. So here it states that karma born, matter arises at which moment? At the first moment of rebirth linking. And then all through life, at every sub moment, karma born, rupa is produced. And then consciousness born from the second moment of consciousness. Here consciousness means bhavanga. The second moment of consciousness means the first bhavanga. So beginning with the arising moment of first bhavanga, consciousness born, matter is produced at every first moment of every citta. And temperature born, matter is produced when the material properties reach the stage of presence. That means when they pass the stage of arising. And nutriment born, material properties are produced from the time of the diffusion of nutritive essence. That means actually we cannot say at what precise moment the nutriment born matter was produced for the first time in one life. Sometimes people say there is nutriment in the body of the mother, and when that comes into contact with the nutriment in the fetus, then the nutriment born matter is produced. So we cannot really say at what precise moment the nutriment born rupas are produced. But with regard to other three, we can really pinpoint the first moment when they arise in one life. Now this is the first arising of these material properties in one life. Now we want to know when they last arise in one life. By the time of death, karma-born material phenomena no longer arise, starting with the stage of presence of the 17th consciousness preceding the death consciousness. I don't know whether you have the dying thought process or in the book, yes. So, at the time of death, karma-born material phenomena or karma-born rupa no longer arise, starting with the stage of presence of the 17th consciousness preceding the death consciousness. Now, you know that rupa lasts for 17 thought moments, right? And karma-born matter must disappear with the last moment of death consciousness. Since it must disappear at the last moment of death consciousness, then we go back from death to until we reach the 17th thought moment. So, reckoning from the death consciousness backward until the 17th thought moment, so at the arising moment of that 17th thought moment, the karma-born matter arises. But it is the last arising of karma born matter. Although normally karma born matter is produced at every sub moment, but now karma born matter is no longer produced, beginning with the present moment of the 17th thought moment, reckoned backward from dead consciousness. Now 17 thought moments reckoned backward from or preceding the dead consciousness means you have to include dead consciousness as one, not dead consciousness as zero and then one, two and so on. So in that case you will get 18 thought moments. Now you need only 17 thought moments. So the 17 consciousness preceding the dead consciousness from the present stage of that thought moment, karma born rupa are no longer produced. So the karma born rupa that is produced at the arising moment of the 17th thought moment from the death ceases with the last moment of death consciousness. So please note that karma born metta must disappear with death, and it cannot go on after death. So karma born material phenomena that arose earlier occur till the death moment and then cease. Following that, the consciousness born and nutriment born material phenomena come to cessation. So after that, after the karma born matter has disappeared, then also the consciousness born and nutriment born material phenomena came to cessation. Thereafter, a continuity of material qualities produced by temperature persists in the form of the corpse, actually persists until the time it is called a corpse. But actually, even after that, the temperature-born rupas persist. Because temperature-born rupas can go on and on, arising and disappearing, even after the corpse have become just a powder or just particles. So actually, the karma-born matter will go on and on and on until the end of this world. Now, the manual does not say when consciousness-born matter ceases and when nutriment-born matter ceases. Now, it is said that citta can produce citta-born matter. So citta-born matter that is produced at the arising moment of death consciousness will go on existing for 17 thought moments. So it will go on existing for 17 thought moments and it will cease or it will disappear when 17 thought moments are complete. Now, the consciousness-born matter that are produced at the arising moment of death consciousness will cease how many moments after death? Death is one moment, and then plus 16 moments. So the consciousness-born matter that is last produced in one life will go on existing until 16 thought moments after death moment. By sub-moment, there are 48. And it is said that nutriment-born matter can be produced even at the moment of the dissolution moment of death. So at the dissolution moment of death, nutriment born rupa is produced. And it will go on for 17 thought movements or 51 sub-moments. So the nutriment-born matter will see how many sub-moments after that moment. It is last produced at the last moment of death. So there is one sub-moment there. And then it will go on until it reaches 51st moment, right? So that means 50 sub-moments after the last moment of death, nutriment-born matter will also cease. And with regard to temperature-born, it will go on and on and on. Not only when it is called a corpse, but actually until the end of the world. Now please turn to the chart in the handout. The first arising and final cessation of matter. I think that is not in the book. Now you see first bhavanga and then past bhavanga, vibrational bhavanga, arrest bhavanga, and then five sense door advading and so on. So where is death consciousness? The last one, CU, chuti. So you reckon backward until you come to the 17th thought moment. So there, at the arising sub-moment of the 17th thought moment, backward from chuti, backward from death, that is the last moment of arising of karma-born matter. So at that moment, karma-born matter arises for the last time. So that karma-born matter will go on 17 thought moments, and with the third sub-moment of death, it will cease. So the final cessation of karma-born matter occurs at the last sub-moment of death consciousness. From the second sub-moment of 17th thought moment, no more karma-born matter arises. So no more karma-born matter from that moment until death. Now with regard to chitta-born or mind-born matter, consciousness is strongest at the moment of arising. So the arising sub-moment of chuti, death, is the last moment of arising of mind-born matter. And so it will go on existing until 17 moments are complete, and so that we have this here. The first moment of arising, this is the next life. So that mind-born matter will cease with the 16 thought moments after that moment. So you see under Bhavanga 16, final cessation of nutriment, or under 15, final cessation of mind-born matter of previous life. And then at the dissolution moment of death, the last moment of arising of nutriment-born matter. So at the nutriment-born matter arises for the last time at that moment. And that will go on while a new rebirth takes place. And it will cease when it reaches the 51st sub-moment, and that is final cessation of nutriment-born matter of previous life, that is at the present moment of the 16th bhavanga after Patisandhi. So now we know when the rupas arise, the different rupas caused by karma and so on arise for the first time in life, and also when the arise for the last time in one life and also when they cease. They accept karma-born matter, the matter born of other causes will continue even after death. But since thought moments are very brief, it may be almost instantaneous or almost after death. Because 48 the sub-moments or 50 sub-moments are nothing when we think of the billions of thought moments in a second. So this is the first arising and final cessation of matter in one life. But in the Brahmas, in the fine material world, the decades of nose, tongue, body, sex, and the material groups produced by nutriment are not found. So in the Brahmas, there is no nose decade, tongue decade, body decade, sex decade, and also material groups produced by nutriment. Because they do not eat, so they have no external nutriment. Since they have no external nutriment, there is no nutriment-born matter produced there. Therefore, to those beings at the time of rebirth linking, there arise four material groups produced by karma, and they are the three decades of eye, ear, heart base, and then vital, non-net. So only four decades arise at the moment of rebirth linking. During the course of existence, that is after relinking, material phenomena produced by consciousness and by temperature are also found. So they are also found. So during the course of existence, material phenomena produced by consciousness. So those produced by consciousness arise, and also those produced by temperature arise. And among the non-percipient beings, the eye, ear, heart base, and sound are also, that means in addition to what has been mentioned above, and also not found. Actually, similarly, no consciousness-born material phenomena are found. So no rupa caused by chaita arise in the non-percipient beings. So they have also no eye decad, ear decad, heart base decad, and sound also not found, in addition to eye decad, ear decad, and heart base decad. Therefore, at the moment of their rebirth linking, only the vital non-net arises. There is only vital non-net. That means only nine material properties. During the course of existence, after rebirth, material phenomena produced by temperature, with the exception of sound, continue. So those produced by temperature will also arise in them. Thus, in the three cases of sensuous world, the fine material world, and non-percipient beings, the occurrence of material phenomena should be understood as twofold by way of rebirth linking and the course of existence. So, at the moment of rebirth linking and then during life. In the sense planes, 28 material phenomena are found. So in Kamavachara realms, there are all 28 material properties. In fine material planes, only 23. So 5 are missing. Among the non-percipients, 17. But none in the immaterial plane. At the moment of conception, the sound, mutability, decay, and death are not found. So these sound, mutability, decay, and death, these who are not found at the moment of conception. In the course of existence, there is nothing that is not obtained. So in the course of existence, that is after rebirth, there is nothing and that is not found. So that is how rupa arise and disappear in one life and also in different lives. Okay, now we come to Nibbana. Nibbana is termed supramundane and is to be realized by the knowledge of the four paths. So Nibbana belongs to supramundane sphere, not mundane. And it is to be realized by the knowledge of the four paths. So only when we get the four paths can we really see or can we really experience Nibbana. And it's called Nibbana because it is a departure from craving, which is an entanglement. Now, the notes. The concluding section on this chapter deals briefly with the fourth ultimate reality, Nibbana. So we studied that there are four ultimate realities, and we have studied them in first chapter, second chapter, and so on until the sixth chapter. Now, Nibbana is treated just in one section, like an appendix to the sixth section. So very briefly, Nibbana is explained here. Etymologically, the word Nibbana, the Pali form of the better known Sanskrit Nirvana, is derived from a verb Nibbati, meaning to be blown out or to be distinguished. It thus signifies the extinguishing of worldly fires of greed, hatred, and delusion. So Nibbana means blowing out. And blowing out of what? Blowing out of the fire of greed, fire of hate, fire of delusion, or blowing out of all mental defilements. It thus signifies the extinguishing of the worldly fires of greed, hatred, and delusion. But the Pali commentators prefer to treat it as the negation of or departure from the entanglement of craving, the derivation which is offered here means in this manual. So the Pali commentators say Nibbana is a combination of Ni and Vana. So Ni and Vana, when combined, becomes Nibbana. And Vana is here translated as entanglement. Now, Vana is the name of craving. Craving is called Vana because it stitches one life with another. So long as there is craving, then the rebirth will be produced. So since rebirths are produced because there is craving, craving is said to be stitching these existences together. So craving is called Vana because it stitches together the existences. And here Ni means getting out of or departure from. Getting out of or departure from craving means getting out of the range of objects of craving. Now, craving cannot take Nibbana as object. If you go back to the third chapter, you will see that craving or akusala takes only the mundane objects as object. Craving cannot take supramundane states as object. So Nibbana is said to get out of the range of craving. So it is called Nibbana, getting out of the range of the objects of craving. As long as one is entangled by craving, one remains bound in samsara, the cycle of birth and death. But when all craving has been extirpated, one attains Nibbana, deliverance from the cycle of birth and death. So it is, Nibbana is defined as something that gets out of, that goes beyond the range of craving. Nibbana is also explained as something by which the fires of greed and so on comes to be extinguished. So in this case, Nibbana is something, it is very difficult to describe. So when we say something, then people may think that it is something and so it must have a beginning and an end. But Nibbana has no beginning and so it has no end. So we cannot call it a state. But in Pali it is called a dhatu element. Nibbana is called element because it has its own intrinsic nature, that is unconditioned, depthless element, totally transcendent to the conditioned world. So in that case, Nibbana is a dhatu or an element. And Nibbana is here described as first supramundane. So we must understand that Nibbana belongs to supramundane sphere, and it is said to be realized by the knowledge of the four paths. That means it is a ultimate reality. It does not reside in the imagination of people. It is a real state that can be realized by the four path knowledges. So by this, the author shows that Nibbana is not nothing. It is something that can be realized. And also it says it is the object of Magga and Phala. It becomes an object to the path and fruit. That means it is the object of path and fruit. So when path consciousness arises, it takes Nibbana as object. And when Phala or fruition consciousness arises, it takes Nibbana as object. So since it is the object of path and fruit, it is a reality. And it can be realized through the attainment of path and fruition. So Nibbana is not a realm or not an existence. Many people think Nibbana to be something like an existence or a realm. And that is why we say we go to Nibbana, or we enter Nibbana and so on, or we reach Nibbana. Reaching Nibbana may be all right, but go to Nibbana or to reach Nibbana is just figurative language. It is not a true language, because Nibbana is not a place or not a realm to go to. It is just a state of peace, manifested as the destruction of mental defilements and also destruction of the aggregates. So we should say, may I attain or may I experience Nibbana, rather than saying, may I go to Nibbana or may I reach Nibbana. So Nibbana is actually not a state, not a realm, not a place, but it is an element which has its own intrinsic nature of being transcendent to the conditional world, being out of the conditional world. So Nibbana is actually, by this definition, just one. There is no many Nibbanas according to this definition. But when we consider the basis for distinction, then it is of two kinds. That means the being with the aggregates remaining and being without aggregates remaining. So if we consider this, then we can say there are two kinds of Nibbanas. So though Nibbana is onefold according to its intrinsic nature, by reference to a basis for distinction, it is twofold, namely the element of Nibbana with the aggregates remaining and the element of Nibbana without the aggregates remaining. So instead of residue, I think we should have aggregates. Now please look at the Pali word. The first one is sa upadisesa nibbana dhatu. So dhatu is element, nibbana is nibbana. Sa means with, upadi means aggregates, and sesa means remaining. So the element of nibbana, which is with the aggregates remaining. And the other word is anu padi sesa nibbana dhatu. This is the opposite of sa. Sa means with, and an means not. So with no aggregates remaining. So there are two kinds of nibbana according to this differentiation. So the first one is called in Pali sa upadi sesa nibbana dhatu. The element of nibbana with the aggregates remaining. And the second one is anubadisesa nibbana dhatu, the element of nibbana which is without the aggregates remaining. Now in the word sa upadisesa, there is the word upadi and sesa. Now upadi is explained as something that is clung to by karma and also by essential desire and so on. So those that are grasped by, that are clung to by the sensual desire and so on, are called upadi. So upadi is the name of the five aggregates. We can grasp at these five aggregates with sensual desire, with wrong view, so they are called upadi. And sesa means remaining. So sa means with. So the first nibbana is nibbana with the aggregates remaining. Now when a person becomes an arahant, he eradicates mental defilement. So, after the eradication of mental defilements, then they are gone. But what remains? His physical body remains, and also the other types of consciousness and chetisikas remain with him. So he still experiences other types of consciousness. He still experiences other mental factors. But from the moment he became an arahant, he no longer experiences any of the 10 mental defilements. So he does not experience attachment or greed, does not experience anger, hate, does not experience illusion, and so on. So for an arahant, what remains is these aggregates. And what are destroyed are the mental defilements. So at the moment he became an arahant, he is said to realize this sa upadisesa nibbana dhatu, because he realizes nibbana with the aggregates remaining. So he still has these aggregates, but he can experience nibbana. Sa upadisesa nibbana is one nibbana which an arahant experiences during his lifetime before he dies. And this sa upadisesa nibbana dhatu is also called destruction of mental defilement. So on the next page, kilesa parinibbana, extinguishment of that defilement. So kilesa parinibbana and sa upadisesa nibbana dhatu are the same. And the other one is anupadisesa nibbana. Now when an arahant dies, then the remaining aggregates also disappear. So nothing is produced after the death of an arahant. So after the death of an arahant, there are no remaining aggregates, and the nibbana that becomes evident at the death or after the death of an arahant is called anupadisesa nibbana dhatu. Now we are not to say that anupadisesa nibbana dhatu is an element of nibbana which an arahant experiences after his death, because after the death of an arahant there is no arahant at all, as Buddha explained. He disappears like a lamp. When the lamp is extinguished, then it just disappears. So in the same way, when an arahant dies, then he just dies. That means his remaining aggregate cease. After the cessation of his aggregate, nothing is produced. So that is the end of his samsara. So we cannot say that the anupadisesa nibbana dhatu is the one that he experiences after his death. So we should say that becomes evident after his death. And that anupadisesa nibbana is also called khanda parinibbana, extinguishment of the aggregates, because at death the remaining aggregates are extinguished or they cease to exist. So there are these two kinds of nibbana if we base our differentiation on whether the aggregates are remaining and not remaining. And there is another classification of nibbana, and that is into void, signless, and desireless. So in this case, nibbana is threefold, according to its different aspects, namely void, signless, and desireless. Now here, void means devoid of greed, hatred, and delusion. Now please understand the word void or sunya in Theravada Buddhism. The sunya or sunyata is also used in Theravada discourses. But in Theravada literature, sunyata means not just void, but it is void of greed, hatred, and delusion. So when Buddha said the I is sunya, that means the I is not adda. The I does not belong to any adda. So void in Theravada means void of adda or something that belongs to adda, and also like here, void of greed, hatred, and delusion. There is no greed, no hatred, and no delusion in nibbana, and so nibbana is called sunyata. And it is also called signless, without signs. Here also, greed, hatred, and delusion are called signs, because we understand people by these signs. Now this person is greedy, this person is angry, this person is deluded. So these are called signs. But in nibbana there are no such signs as greed, hate, and delusion, and so nibbana is called animita, signless, without signs. Sign means the greed, hate, delusion, and also from the sign of impermanent suffering and non-soul, a sign of all conditioned things. Since nibbana does not arise, it has no beginning, and so it has no end. So we cannot take nibbana as the object of vipassana meditation, because nibbana does not possess the three characteristics of impermanence and so on. And nibbana is also called appanihita, desireless. But here, the word desire does not mean just desire. It means again greed, hate, and delusion. Although there are three names, sunyata, animita, and apanihita, they mean the same thing. Nibbana, which is devoid of greed, hate, and delusion, is Nibbana, which has no signs of greed, hate, and delusion. And it is a Nibbana that is free from hankering of greed, hate, and delusion. So in this sense, Nibbana is threefold. So first there is just one Nibbana, then there are two Nibbanas, and then again there are three Nibbanas. The second division is according to it is twofold, namely the element of Nibbana with the residue remaining and the element of Nibbana without the residue remaining. It is threefold. By reference to a basis for distinction. So by reference to a basis for distinction, there are two. And by its different aspects, Nibbana is said to be threefold. So now we come to the close to the end of the sixth chapter. So this is just a summary. Summary means a statement about Nibbana for helping your memory. So great seers who are free from craving declare that Nibbana is an objective state. So Nibbana is an objective state. Nibbana is never subject. And Nibbana is never in the mind or mental. Just Nibbana, it is no rupa, no nama, it is not mind, it is not matter, but it is distinct from mind and matter, and it is an objective state. It is the object of path and consciousness. So Nibbana is an ultimate reality, an objective state, which is deathless. So Nibbana is deathless simply because it has no rebirth, simply because it has no beginning. So something that has no beginning has no end or no death. So it is, Nibbana is called deathless simply because it is without beginning. Absolutely endless. That means Nibbana is always there. We cannot say Nibbana ceases at some time or some moment. And it is unconditioned, not conditioned by anything at all in the world. It is not produced by, it is not created by anything. It is by its own intrinsic nature. And it is unsurpassed, because when a person attains Nibbana, then he gets free from mental defilement and he gets free from suffering. So now we come to the end of the four ultimate realities: citta, cetasika, rupa, and Nibbana. So now we come to the end of the sixth chapter, or the second part of our Abhidhamma class. So we will have to continue this class in the future, and I think we can finish the remaining chapters during the third part of our class. I'm glad that I came this time and continue my teaching of Abhidhamma, and I'm very encouraged by the attendance, because every day the hall is full, not because you come to my teaching, but because it shows that there are many people interested in Abhidhamma in Singapore. Yeah, you are lay people, most of you are lay people, and still you are interested in Abhidhamma, so that's a good sign. As I told you, Abhidhamma has come to stay with us, and we cannot just throw it away, and so we have to try to understand it, and through the understanding of Abhidhamma, or through the knowledge of Abhidhamma, our knowledge of Buddha's teachings have greatly increased. So without the knowledge of Abhidhamma, we can go wrong in many places. If you are interested in Theravada teachings, then you have to study Abhidhamma. And Abhidhamma study step by step, little by little, is not so difficult. Any subject which is new to us is difficult at the beginning. Even the subjects taught at the universities or even at schools, when we learn it first, it is difficult for us. But little by little, we get more familiar with the subject, and later on we became very familiar with the subject. And Abhidhamma is also like that. And Abhidhamma is not just to study once. You have to go through it again and again. On the second reading, you will understand more fully. And on the third reading, again more fully, and so on. So after about 5 or 6 readings, you will become not only students of Abhidhamma, you will become experts in Abhidhamma. So I'm glad that I am instrumental in you having the knowledge of Abhidhamma. And whenever I teach Abhidhamma, I'm very glad. So many people think that I would be tired. So long as I'm talking, I'm not tired. So I will end the class in the future. And I thank those who sponsor this class. There are how many sponsors here? Five sponsors. Singapore Buddhist Federation, Ananamitya Rama Buddhist Youth Circle, Buddhist Fellowship, Leong San Si Temple, Palelai Buddhist Temple. So if you do not sponsor this class, there would not be this class, and I would not be here, and so I would not be teaching Abhidhamma to you. I'm grateful to you for giving me this opportunity. So we monks live for all beings. So long as we are able, we must be imparting the knowledge we have gained through our studies. And so I'm very glad that I'm able to make you at least students of Abhidhamma. So and I hope that you will multiply yourselves. That means one will teach at least one more. The population of Abhidhamma students will increase. So in this way, we can spread Abhidhamma in the country and in all in other countries as well. So thank you for inviting me to teach this class.